welcome back to another Scouting Post podcast. This is Kirk Ludeke. Thanks for joining me on St. Patrick's Day, March 17th, 2016. For those of you that are Irish, I hope you're going to have a good day today. And for those of you who aren't, wear green and support the great St. Paddy as we honor and observe our Irish heritage that so many Americans bring to the table. So I am back with a podcast, kind of a Boston Bruins and hockey update in general. I'm going to talk about several topics today, mainly Boston's current West Coast road trip, which began in disappointing fashion with a 3-2 loss to the San Jose Sharks on Tuesday. It continues here tomorrow and Saturday with two pivotal games against the Los Angeles Kings and Anaheim Ducks. Before they head back to the East Coast, and then we'll have a game against the New York Rangers, who they're vying for position in the Eastern Conference, although the Rangers are a Metropolitan Division team, for a playoff spot. So this is a stretch of three critical games upcoming. The good news is the Bruins did a nice job of winning the beginning portion, tough portion of the schedule in March, that a lot of people, myself included, thought where they were going to struggle with. So they're in a good spot, even if things go south for them over this next stretch of games where 6 points are up for grabs, they have a chance. Additionally, I'm going to talk about a couple of prospects that fans have some interest in, namely Frank Vetrano, who was recently brought up on an emergency recall basis but has already been returned to Providence without playing a game. And we'll talk about Frank and the remarkable season he's had in Providence and what could lie ahead for him as he makes the Boston Bruins on a more full-time basis, probably next season and going forward, though we may see him before the end of the year back with the big team, depending on how things go with injuries and general play overall. And then I'm going to close out the podcast with some comments on the 2016 NHL Draft. I've recently put together my first initial watch list of draft prospects that might be in the Bruins wheelhouse. Now, while this is a Bruins-centric podcast, if you're just a fan of other teams and you're interested in the NHL draft in general, you might find that last segment of this podcast intriguing. So thanks for joining me. And on that note, let's talk a little bit about where the Bruins are on St. Patrick's Day. So I opened the segment discussing the loss to the San Jose Sharks the other night. And that was a game that the Bruins fell behind early on, thanks to a goal from Melker Carlson after the Boston's lineup, the Pastrnak line there, had a tough time and lost track of him and let him get to the net, and he was able to score. But the Bruins got goals right back, and again it was that line again. Pastrnak, Krejci, Louis Erickson came through with David Pastrnak getting a shot on the net, and James Reimer, the Sharks goalie, kicked the rebound straight out to Krejci, who buried it for his 15th goal of the season. And then shortly thereafter, with the Bruins killing a penalty, Krejci put the puck into space. Really nice play. He was kind of turned the other way, flipped the puck back, and Louis Erickson was breaking. He was able to put the puck in off the post to give Boston a 2-1 lead after one period. Unfortunately for the Bruins, that would be all for their offense. They had some really good chances throughout the rest of the game. Sharks were able to come back and tie it, and then ultimately the Bruins gave up a goal in the third period and were just not able to. And that was a Jonas Donskoi deflection on the power play, and the Bruins were unable to get some goals. They had a couple glittering chances, including a David Krejci in alone on Reimer after he was hit with a nice pass as the trailer on the play, and for some reason the Sharks defense weren't in position to cover him. He went in and he just ran out of real estate, and Reimer did the splits and Krejci put the puck off the post on the outside. And at the very end of the game, Paul Martin inexplicably threw the puck into the middle of the ice, and Tory Krug recognized the play, took the puck, and went in alone again in the final seconds. And he put a good shot on the net, but Reimer was up to the task, and he saved it. That would have been a huge goal, obviously, for the Bruins. It would have sent the game to overtime in the final seconds, and certainly secured a point, which would have been really nice for the Bruins. But unfortunately, Tory Krug has just been snake bit this year. It isn't for a lack of trying. He's a terrific player and person, and it's tough when you're a player like him who has scored double digit goals in each of his first two full NHL seasons, and then this year he's shooting down around 2%, and he only has 3 goals, and people are saying, hey, what's wrong with him, or he's not the player he was. And I don't agree with that. I think he's the same player. It's just one of those things. When you have game played by humans, sometimes things go your way, you'll do everything right, and either the puck will hit the post or a goalie will make a great save, and you aren't rewarded. And sometimes you get lucky and goals are going in left and right, due more to luck than skill. And I think Tory Krug is probably thinking about it a bit, might be gripping the stick a little tight. But again, I don't have a problem with his play. He's getting himself in position. He's getting shots to the net. It's just they're not going in, and that would have been awesome for him. It might have really invigorated him and maybe opened the floodgate, so to speak. But this is not Tory Krug's year in terms of goal scoring. But when you look at what he's doing in terms of moving the puck and he's getting assists, he's already at a career best. He's got 33 assists on the season. That's the best single season assist total that he's had. So it isn't like he's completely gone dry and isn't providing any kind of an impact. But certainly those folks out there that are concerned about Tory Krug and the kind of contract he's going to get, look, you can't worry about that. That's up to the Bruins to decide and determine his value. And I think if you look at some of the contracts around the league that some of the younger defensemen kind of in Tory Krug's age group and in terms of similar production, he's probably going to get somewhere around $5 million a season. And that's the market value. And Bruins fans should not be opposed to that as much as they should understand that that's just kind of how these things work. And there's a very good chance that Krug, when he gets his goal scoring back on track, and he will, because again, he's making plays and he's getting himself in position to get pucks to the net. They're just not going in. There's a big difference between a guy that isn't doing much and getting not generating much in the way of quality scoring chances and shots on goal, and isn't scoring and doesn't get many shots per game, versus a player like Tory Krug, who really is able to push the pace and carry the puck and create scoring chances for himself and get open. So, and I know there's always going to be an argument. Krug is a bit of a polarizing player for the Bruins and Bruins fans. Those folks that don't care for his lack of size and don't understand what a great locker room presence and leader and character player he is, and why the coaches trust him and respect him so much, they're never going to get it, because to them, they just look at his vitals, his height, his weight. They look at the fact that he's got 3 goals, and that just reinforces their own confirmation bias that he's not worth it. But I would submit to you, where else are they going to get a defenseman that's going to make them better as a unit? I mean, if you subtract Krug, you better have a better, you need a better option in place. And if Joe Morrow and Colin Miller were that impressive to the coaches, they'd probably be on the team getting more of a role. So I'll just leave it there. But that was a disappointing regulation loss. Bruins got no points out of it. That sets up a little more pressure for them as they will get ready to play the Kings and the Ducks this weekend. Two power teams in the West. The Kings are pretty much every year, if they're not just barely missing the playoffs and they're getting in, then they're a Stanley Cup contender, because they have Jonathan Quick between the pipes. They have a lot of depth up front. They've got a very good defense, and they're tough to play against. The Ducks started really, really poorly this season. Just couldn't really get to seem to get much going offensively, and they've, as one would expect with all the talent they have up front, they pulled it together, and they've been quite a surging team over the, you know, the second half of the season for sure. And really, you know, really once we got into late November, December, they've been a tough draw. And so the Bruins are certainly going to have their hands full. I think what's going to be key for them in these two weekend games is they're going to have to limit the mental mistakes. They're going to have to get better with their exits. They really seem to kind of struggle a bit in terms of hitting on their passing. San Jose Sharks employed an effective forecheck that was disruptive, and the Bruins were having a difficult time making accurate, crisp outlets, which would then allow them to break that forecheck and attack the neutral zone with speed. I saw that the Bruins seemed to have an inability to make that consistent first pass because the F1 and the F2 pressure was so consistent and effective and disruptive. And that's what happens when you have forwards that can really skate and are smart. You look at a player like Joel Ward, he's a perfect fit in San Jose. He's not a high-end scorer, but he's opportunistic and he's smart, and years of paying his dues and playing at multiple levels before he got his opportunity to skate in the NHL have showed us that a player like Joel Ward will create a problem because he's not only quick, but he's smart. And he's seen a lot of different situations and scenarios over the course of his career, and so, you know, he'll force you to turn the puck over. Donskoy is another guy that's just really impressive in terms of how he just flat out motors around the ice and brings a good skill level and good hockey sense, and can just really fill those passing lanes and prevent teams from really generating a lot of speed and momentum out of their own end. And that's really the name of the game in the modern NHL, putting defenses on their heels so that they're not standing you up at the blue line and slowing you down. Some teams, you know, prefer the old, and this is certainly Boston. They like the dump and chase, and you know, they like to be able to turn the puck over in at the opposing blue line and then go in and get it. The problem is if you do not have a full head of steam coming through the neutral zone when you're doing that, it really limits your ability to maximize your effectiveness on the dump and chase, because a team that is you know, defending has the advantage to be able to go get that puck. And if you're not attacking them with max speed, you know, the inevitable is going to happen where they're probably going to, their defensemen who are a little quicker and have the benefit of that extra, the extra space and feet that they have on you when you give that, when you surrender possession of the puck and throw it into the zone, they can turn and burn and get back in retrieval. This is why mobile defensemen are so important in the modern NHL, because if you're playing that dump and chase style, in the old days when defensemen were bigger but less mobile, the quicker forwards would throw the puck in, blow by them, and then go and get it in the offensive zone. And now these defensemen that have the wheels and the ability to turn and transition smoothly are able to beat that because they can get back quickly, you know, beat the forward to the puck on the back end, and then they transition out to their own forwards who can, kickstart the attack going back the other way. So unfortunately for Boston, they did have some scoring chances against the Sharks. They certainly brought the effort and the ability to win a game against the Pacific Division third place club, which seems pretty entrenched. But they just weren't able to do, you know, to attack San Jose with any degree of consistency, and it ended up being too little too late. So that's kind of where the Bruins are right now. I'm going to segue the podcast to my next segment and talk about Frank Vatrano. So Frankie Vats, Frank Vatrano, one of the real major success stories of the Boston Bruins this season. A year ago, he was just completing his first full NCAA season. He did play a couple games at the end of 2013-14 for the UMass Minutemen. But a year ago, he was a 0.5 goal a game player as a freshman, or really more of a sophomore. I guess he wasn't a freshman. He was a sophomore at UMass. And apparently, Bruins saw enough and offered him a contract, and he jumped at it. So he jumped and turned pro and got some games in at the end of the season, and the Bruins sat him down and said, you know, Frank, you have this great shot and this great ability to create offense, but you're carrying some extra weight, and you're really going to have to demonstrate a commitment to being a pro and doing being the best person you can be in order to have a chance to play at the highest level, and give the kid credit. I mean, he took it to heart, and he went home over the summer in the off season, dedicated himself to John Whiteside's conditioning program, and worked with his trainer there, and came to camp, having lost about 15 to 20 pounds. He was quicker, more agile, and more importantly, he was able to take a hard shift and then recover much faster than he did when he was carrying that extra weight around. And I think he kind of saw the light and said, wow, you know, I'm a much better player the way I am. And so really took off at the rookie camp and the rookie tournament in Buffalo. He and Austin Zarnik played just really inspired hockey and opened a lot of eyes. And then what's more important is they carried that over into the main camp with the veterans. Both had extended looks in the preseason, got some time to make their magic in the exhibition games. And although both were sent down, they really were in a good spot to use that success and that confidence as a springboard going forward with the new season. For Frank Vetrano, he just started like a house on fire, came on like gangbusters, whatever you want to call it. But he had a 4-goal game right off the bat, and he was a goal a game player after 10 games with the Providence Bruins, and a real revelation. And the Bruins called him up and gave him an opportunity, and lo and behold, he scores in his very first NHL game against the Montreal Canadiens at the Bell Center. And that's just a dream come true for a local kid who grew up dreaming of playing for the Bruins. Although I say local, he's from Western Mass. He's from the Springfield area, and that's why I call him the Springfield Rifle. I think that's a good nickname for him because he does have such a lethal shot. And East Longmeadow is right there in Springfield out west. But the local kid is a relative way of speaking. You know, he did grow up as a Boston sports fan. And to have this opportunity has got to be pretty exciting for him. He followed that up and did manage to register his first NHL hat trick, which is something that higher profile players and players with high draft pedigrees, don't always do when they come up to the NHL right away. So he did that in December against the Pittsburgh Penguins. And, it's about being good and lucky. Hat tricks happen because of opportunity, and just as I was saying with Torrey Krug, sometimes you can do everything right and the puck doesn't go in for you, and then sometimes you really don't have to make much of a play, and you'll get some good puck luck and things will go your way, and before you know it, you have your first 3-goal game in the NHL. So Frankie played 30 games for the Bruins, had 6 goals, so his consistent impact offensively was limited, and he did have the benefit of playing in the Winter Classic on New Year's Day, but he was returned to Providence shortly thereafter. And boy, once he went back to Providence, the guy just has been unreal. He was called up to Boston. He had 10 goals. After going back to Providence, he now has 31 goals in 31 games. And I put some things on Twitter over the weekend to kind of put that in perspective. And one of the things I pointed out, the last time the Bruins had a 30 goal scorer in fewer than 50 games was Landon Wilson. I'm not comparing Vetrano to Wilson by any stretch, but Landon Wilson did it in 98-99, which incidentally was the one and only year that the Providence Bruins won the Calder Cup championship of the AHL. They had a stacked team that year. Peter Laviolette was the coach. But that was the last time it happened. We're coming up on 20 years ago, so it is not an easy feat to score 30 goals in less than 50 games. Although people do it, but what's even more remarkable about Vetrano is he scored 31 goals in 31 games. So it's actually in his case we're talking about fewer than 40 games that he's played, and he's hit the 30 goal mark. And when you narrow those parameters, now you're talking about a pretty exceedingly rare feat. You just don't see many players score that many goals in the AHL at that clip, you know, at that rate of games. And I think if you go back, Brad Smith scored 68 goals in 68 games back in 1996, and that would be the most comparable projection of a player staying in the AHL and scoring at a goal per game clip over a sustained basis like that. So Frankie Vetrano's in select company, and I think when we look at his future, what I like about him is he's not only quick and fast, and of course he's got that lethal shot, but he's energetic and he hustles. He wants to be a good defensive player. He's not there yet. He's still kind of, he's got to learn about positioning, and he's got to learn about, you know, get the game experiences and play a lot to increase his own game situation, game awareness, and overall experience. And then he'll be able to take that dedication and that willingness to back check and that willingness to play hard on the puck in his own zone, not just in the offensive end. But if he's in Boston right now, what's he doing? He's probably, best he could hope for is third, fourth line duty. He's not seeing as many situations. I don't know that sitting him on the bench and not getting a lot of chances to play and skate and see prime power play minutes and see time on the penalty kill, which is what he's getting in Providence, is the smartest thing. And so I have to think that's kind of what's driving the coaches right now to not have him. And I know fans love their shiny new toys, and they look at his stats and they say, hey, this guy could be, you know, this guy could be up right now, but the top two lines are pretty well settled, and you don't, you know, there's not an immediate demand signal to plug Vetrano in and expect him to start playing with Bergeron or Krejci, because I mean the team is getting some pretty effective production. Where you can make the case to have Vetrano is on the third and the fourth lines, and certainly we need to see more from Jimmy Hayes. I think he has 0 points in his last 10 games, and given what the Bruins gave up for him and what the expectations were and the way Riley Smith is playing in Florida, it's just really disappointing right now. Jimmy Hayes is just not being able to find a way to make an impact on the score sheet and to be much of a consistent offensive threat. So you can certainly make a case that you could replace Hayes or maybe even Brett Connolly with Vetrano, but again, I submit to you, as I said earlier, you know, what's the downside to that? Well, he's not going to get a lot of minutes, and he's not going to play a lot, and he's not going to do the things that he's really been able to accomplish in Providence, where he's a top line guy, and he's seeing a lot of opportunity to develop his game. I think in Boston he would probably contribute, but he's not ready to be that top six forward who's gonna maximize his terrific shot and his ability to get things done. So I know people will disagree with that, and that's fine. But, you know, again, we're looking at Vetrano. He's down in Providence. So if the coaches saw it the way you do, if you think he needs to be in the lineup right now, then he'd probably be in the lineup right now. And that's, you know, sometimes it's not so simple as take the most skilled guy and stick him in there. Sometimes you have to take the economics into account. And the fact of the matter is, Jimmy Hayes is making pretty good coin to be on the Boston Bruins. And if the team doesn't feel like it's a good use of those resources to have him down in Providence and have Vetrano up, then that's the decision they'll have to make. I suspect they're getting to the point where they're going to be looking for more impactful options. So I think we could very well see Vetrano back in Boston at some point. But you know, he's the shiny new toy, and we shouldn't press for it. So. Good on Vetrano. He's a great story, and just goes to show you that you don't have to hit on your draft picks to have success. And so, speaking of the draft, the 2016 NHL draft will be held here at the end of June, the final Saturday or weekend, I should say, Friday and Saturday in June in Buffalo. And it's an interesting class. It's not very strong. It certainly doesn't have the cachet and the excitement that last year's draft class did, where there was a lot of depth and teams were excited and talking about being able to get primetime players into the third round. This one, I'm being told by various sources, they're projecting to have maybe a big drop off in pretty early into the second round. And what does that mean? Well, it means that in the first and second rounds and beyond, you're going to see a lot of variants. So these public lists that will come out, various scouting services and the like, certainly Central Scouting will have players listed, and people will talk about projecting them in the first or second or third round or later. And what we'll actually see happening is players that are projected to go much lower will end up coming off the board earlier, and players that are projected to be, you know, higher picks will fall, and people will have, you know, we'll have that usual paralysis by analysis where people will be, you know, talking about steals and reaches, and, you know, it's going to be fun. And in case you can't tell from the tone of my voice, I'm kind of being sarcastic there. The good news for teams picking in the top 10 of the 2016 draft is that they're gonna come away with some pretty nice talent. It's top heavy and it's got some real good players at the top of the draft. And then after 10, then it's gonna get kind of iffy, and teams are really gonna have to do their homework and their due diligence on players. So. Boston Bruins fans, usually throughout the course of the year on Twitter, will ask me, you know, who are the Bruins looking at? What are they looking to do? And you know, it's very hard to tell you that. You know, when we're talking back in October, November, December, even the beginning part of the calendar year. But now, as we're getting into March, and March is going to give way to April, we've got the NCAA March Madness here about to start. That's usually the time when you can start narrowing the focus, and draft position is really starting to emerge. It looks like the Bruins, they own San Jose's first-round pick by virtue of the Martin Jones trade last summer, and then they have their own first-round pick. So they're looking at two picks in the bottom 10, basically. San Jose's hovering around 20. And then the Bruins right now, by virtue of their current standing, they're in the bottom five jockeying for position. Again, a lot of stuff has yet to be determined. Because if San Jose were to go and make it to the conference semifinal, they'll reshuffle the deck, and that pick will end up being 27 or later. So there's still a lot to be determined. Even if, you know, when the regular season ends, we won't know if that San Jose and that Boston draft position is actually going to be in those numbers, you know, based on how the playoffs shake out. So on that note, looking at some of the players that the Bruins could be in position to take, the first guy that really jumps off the page to me is defenseman Dante Fabbro, plays for the Penticton Vs of the British Columbia Hockey League. It's Tier 2. It's not Major Junior, and the reason for that is he's committed to Boston University. So he is playing at a lower level of competition, but he's a heck of a player. He's one of the real dominant, arguably the best defenseman in the entire league there. He's a productive two-way threat who can really skate. I talked to him for Redline Report a couple of weeks ago, and I was really, really impressed with the way he came off in the interview. He speaks well, he's articulate, and he says things with feeling. You know, sometimes you get around kids and you can kind of tell when they're scripted and when they've been coached by their agents and advisors and their handlers on how to say things and how to engage. And you don't get that sense with Fabbro. He just seems like a real straight up, kind of that fiery, that quiet intensity that kind of burns within some of these players who are driven for success. And I think he's certainly going to raise his profile at the combine during the interview process. Teams will be impressed. If they like him already, then they're really going to like him. And I suspect, based on what he's able, you know, what he brings to the table in terms of his skill set, his wheels, his smarts, his ability to move the puck, I suspect the Bruins would really love to get him if he's available on the board around 20. Some rankings have him pushing the top 10. Other rankings don't. I suspect he's probably going to be off the board when the Bruins pick, but you never know, and they could be fortunate if they stand pat. I don't know if they would move up to get him. He's kind of a similar situation to Charlie McAvoy for BU, where I personally don't think McAvoy is going to be there for them. He's another, you know, higher end puck moving, aggressively push the pace kind of defenseman who has some emerging offensive upside that's really intriguing. And he's been a solid player as a freshman for BU, and his production's probably going to take off here next season, as he'll be a more consistent wire-to-wire, two-way threat, as opposed to kind of got off to a little bit of a more conservative start at the beginning of the season as he worked into and got comfortable. But I just don't think he'll be there, but I'm not sure that he or Fabro are the kind of guys you move up for. The Bruins don't have a great track record in terms of success in moving up to get players, so we'll see what happens there. But I wouldn't take that to the banker, and I wouldn't put a lot of stock. I think if the Bruins are going to expend assets to do anything this summer, they're going to do it. They're going to do so by maybe trading to get an NHL roster defenseman. It would be hard for me to envision that they would surrender a bunch of assets just to move up some spots to take a future option that we don't know whether they're going to ever make the NHL or have the anticipated impact. I think they were willing to do it last year with Noah Hanifin because he was a special potential cornerstone guy, and we're seeing him in the NHL right now with Carolina, even though he's not quite ready for prime time in terms of the impact he's having, but you watch, he looks like he's on the verge of blossoming there real soon. But I don't see I don't see Fabro or McAvoy or really anybody in this particular class is having that kind of potential that you expend a lot of assets and what it would take to move up from where the Boston Bruins are going to be picking. Like, as I said, the problem with them is they've got two picks, but they're in the bottom 10. That makes it very difficult to move up in a draft, because a team that has finished out of the playoffs, their reward for having a poor season is that they get that first kick at the can, or that early kick at the can at a top player. They generally don't want to surrender that for a couple of picks later on, which, put their management and their scouts in position to potentially lose their jobs if that kid that the team they traded their pick to develops and hits, and their two picks later on don't. So I know fans spend a lot of time on Twitter asking about those scenarios, trade up and all that. It's just not that simple, and it doesn't happen with as much regularity as you see it in the National Football League draft. Another player I think is certainly going to get some attention, maybe closer to, and again, my projections and my watch list is based on players or on the fact that the Bruins might pick, keep both of their draft picks in the first round. There's a very good chance they'll trade one, maybe both, depending on the type of player they're getting back. But like I said, I think that trade would be involving an NHL defenseman, not a player that you move up for in this particular draft class, because the Bruins are well aware of their needs at defense, and I don't think they're willing to necessarily stockpile more picks and futures and load up on another bunch of players in this questionable draft class when they can maybe package assets in the form of, maybe a few more of these picks that they have in 2016, plus prospects, maybe a roster player, young, promising roster player they have now, and go get that proven NHL player and roll the dice on that. So, but another guy that I think if they're, that's closer to the end of the first round, depending on where their pick lands, is Finnish defenseman Markus Niemelainen. He's about 6'5", 200-pound player, born in August 98, plays for the Saginaw Spirit of the Ontario Hockey League. Real good skater, real good tools. He's one of these defensemen who's pretty raw right now, and he's got a lot of improving to do. Doesn't shoot the puck with much authority, needs to add power and be able to get his shot off quicker. But he's certainly in the wheelhouse, I think, I've got to think the Bruins would be interested in him just because he's one of those toolsy, hey, if he, you know, when he adds strength and he physically matures and you know, ends up playing closer to 220 pounds, 225 pounds, he will add that power to his shot. And he has the potential to be a pretty darn good two-way defenseman. So right now he's ranked pretty, you know, lower on the boards because that boom potential hasn't really emerged for him this season with Saginaw. But I could see a team like Boston who's picking late, you know, swinging for the fences a bit with him. Another guy along those lines is a player who right now is almost universally projected in the second round. You won't see him on many lists, and this is why I caution you not to get, you know, wrapped around the axle on public lists. We certainly saw this with Zach Senishin last year, where no list had him in the first round. Certainly, Jake DeBrusque was projected almost consensus projection in the 20s, and then the Bruins take those guys early, and people are unhappy. No. That's not how teams, not how NHL teams look at it. They're not basing their lists on the public lists out there. Them rankings and all of that. They're doing their own thing, and so you're looking for what a player does, what a player's potential looks like, and the kind of values that that player has, whether he shares similar values to an organization. So if you look for those players, it makes perfect sense now that Senishin was a top 15 pick for Boston because he brought that scoring, that speed, that size, and that willingness to work the Bruins relish and embrace on the wing. And so, now he has 45 goals for the Sioux Greyhounds a year after getting 26 in a very limited role, and he looks very much like a legit first-round pick that he should have been. So the guy this year that I think will raise eyebrows if the Bruins were to take him in the late first is Kelowna defenseman Lucas Johansson. If the name sounds familiar, it's because his older brother Ryan Johansson is with the Nashville Predators. He was the fourth overall selection of Columbus in 2010. Lucas is a really good skater, four-way guy again, that compass mobility where he can stop, start quickly, skates forward and backwards very well, really agile and fluid mover with his crossovers and his lateral movement, really crisp on his edges, all those things that you need in the modern NHL. So he's going to be good in puck retrieval, he's going to be effective in moving forward and leading the rush, joining the rush, advancing the puck. Real good vision and passing ability. He's about 6'1", 180 pounds, so he's got a lot of filling out to do yet. The thing with Johansson is he's not a very physical defenseman. He's not really hard on guys in the defensive zone, has a tendency to be more of a stick check, play the puck kind of defenseman, and he's got to get better at his reads and the way he processes the game, and that's why he's a second round projection. But I got to tell you, a guy like Johansson in a draft like this, because he's got that higher end offensive upside, he could certainly be a player that comes off the board earlier, and if he does, you know, teams won't be wrong for taking him. Last guy I want to talk about as a potential Bruins pick is Riley Tufte. Personally, I don't think he'll be on the board when they pick. I think he's one of these rising players who's just so big, so talented. Minnesota's Mr. Hockey, had over 3 points a game, had 47 goals in 25 games for Blaine High School. Skates really well for someone who's 6'5", but also not just skates well, but handles the puck extremely well and has great hand-eye coordination and ability to handle the puck and shoot in tight spaces. When you see guys that are 6'5", 6'6", and get that size, it's one thing for them to be able to skate, but a lot of times they lose something in terms of their coordination, their ability to handle the puck. And Riley Tufte is that rare specimen who just seems to have, you know, excellent ability to you know, the deftness and the agility with his feet and his hands. The question is now, can he put it all together with his head? And, you know, being a dominant high school player, we don't know that yet. We'll have to see how he looks at the University of Minnesota Duluth. Just a really good, high upside home run potential pick. And for that reason, I just don't think he's going to be hanging around. You know, some team will jump on him early. But he'd be ideal for what the Bruins are looking for on the left wing side with his size and his skill combo. So more podcasts to come. I want to thank you all for listening, as always. I hope you enjoyed the Bruins update. And then we talked about Frankie Vatrano. And then ultimately we finished with some players for the 2016 draft who could land in Boston's wheelhouse. Enjoy your St. Patrick's Day, and as always, I thank you for listening, and have a great weekend. Let's see how the Bruins do as they finish out their West Coast trip. For the Scouting Post, this is Kirk Ludeke signing off. Take care.